I'll call this meeting of the Joint Senate and House Transportation Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:07 p.m. On Thursday, January 22nd, 2015. And today we have present with us, and I'll let Senator Machicki present the Senate members.
Thank you. Senator Machicki, chair from the Senate side. I'd like to recognize Vice Chair Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy down on the end there, Senator Stedman, who's not currently present, and Senator Egan.
Thank you. And on the House Transportation Committee, we have co-chair Representative Hughes. We have Representative Millett, Representative Stutes, Representative Klayman, Representative Ortiz, and myself, Representative Foster. I don't believe we're missing anybody. Nagyak is not here, I believe. Correct. Oh, correct, yeah. So just as a reminder, if you could please turn off your cell phones, they'll disrupt the recording system. I'd like to also remind members to speak into their microphones. Make sure your comments and questions are, so that your questions are picked up by the recording system. We have two items today on the agenda. The first is we'll receive an update from the Alaska Marine Highway System. We're hoping that we can end that around 1:30 so that we can move on to our second item, which is a discussion on the status of projects, mega projects. And I want to thank the Senate for allowing us to conduct the meeting here in the Senate Finance Room. And I'm going to hang on to the gavel for the first half of this presentation, and then we'll take a short break, at which time we're going to pass the gavel on to co-chair Representative Hughes for the second half of our meeting. So with that, we are going to start with the Alaska Marine Highway System. We have with us Business Development and Enterprise Manager for the Alaska Marine Highway System, Matt McLaren, and also we have General Manager for the Alaska Marine Highway System, Captain John Falvey. And as a requirement of the operating budget passed last year, the Alaska Marine Highway System was required to complete a review and analysis of current passenger, vehicle, and cabin rate structure for the system and present a modified tariff and fee schedule to the legislature no later than February 1 of 2015. So you're early. So thank you for joining us, and I'd ask in the interest of time that the committee members, if we could please hold on to our questions until after the presentation is completed. And Mr. McLaren and Captain Falvey, if you would please introduce yourselves for the record. And one moment. Was Stedman here?
He was not.
Okay. Just for the record, we also want to note that Senator Stedman has also joined us. So.
Can you see us? Okay.
And also, we do have Representative Nagyak with us, so thank you. And if you could please start.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for having the Marine Highway System here today. For the record, my name is Captain John Falvey. I'm the General Manager, Alaska Marine Highway System, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
And Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Matt McLaren. I am the Business Development and Enterprise Manager for Department of Transportation and Alaska Marine Highway System.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to start, we will start with the Marine Highway System overview. I know we've got to move quickly, so I will try to proceed along as quickly as possible, and if we could take the questions at the end, that would be great. What we're going to look at here first is an overview of the Marine Highway System. We're going to take a look at the FY15 look forward. We're going to look quickly at the day boat Alaska class ferries that are currently under construction, and discuss briefly the new reservation and manifest system, which we are currently working on. That's going really well. This is a quick look at our structure. I, in essence, report to a deputy commissioner at the DOT and PF. Reporting directly to me are the marine engineering manager, operations manager, business development. This is Matt McLaren. He also looks after our accounting and whatnot on a local level. We have, at the height of the Marine Highway System during the summertime, approximately 1,018 employees. As you can see the breakdown there, most of it's out on the ships, shoreside facilities, those are our terminals, 87 there, Marine Engineering in the office, reservations at the marketing, the call center, which is here in Juneau, 23, and the administration staff, that's our central office. We do have that reduced to about half of that 840 number during the wintertime as we go from 11 ships down to 5 to 6 ships. As far as the crews, it takes 2.3 crews, in essence, because we work a week on and a week off with vacation to crew the ships. The terminals also get reduced in the wintertime. We do hire a lot of seasonal, summer, on-call type employees. So those numbers go down in the wintertime considerably. Quick look at the fleet. We started with the mainliners, the Malaspina, Taku, Matanuska, Tustamina, Columbia, and Kennecott. We've indicated the dates that they were built from 1963 up till 1998 for the Kennecott. The next class of ship is what we call the 235s, the Aurora class. The MV Aurora and Lakani. The Lakani operates as a day vessel, in essence, out of Juneau. She services the Panhandle and Inland Canal. And the Aurora works as a 24/7 vessel, and she works in Prince William Sound. Then we have the shuttle vessels, the two fast ferries, the Fairweather and Chenega, and the Latoya that runs to Annette Bay. Those are day boats. They come back to their home port every single night. Quick look at the ports. 35 total. We begin in Bellingham, Washington State. That's our southern terminus. We go as far north as Valdez and as far west as Dutch Harbor. That's on the western end. 17 terminals in southeast Canada, Washington, 18, south central, and southwest Alaska. Of the 35 ports, there's a variation as to how we manage the ports. 17 are actually owned by the state. We own those. We do all the maintenance. 12 are manned, 5 are unmanned. What unmanned means is it's a smaller port. The ships, the crews handle, in essence, the loading of the cars and the ticketing. Any tickets that come aboard that aren't already pre-purchased, we do handwritten tickets. Our new reservation system is going to really streamline that process. We do have 4 lease facilities, Bellingham, Prince Rupert, Saldovia, and Kodiak. They have subcontractors, in essence, in those facilities that we, have on contract to manage the ticketing and the passenger loading. We have 14 privately owned terminals. Those are mostly terminals out in the chain, everything from the city-owned docks to cannery docks. So, and a lot of those are unmanned. In essence, as far as the capital projects, maintenance of these facilities, Southeast Region, DOT and PF here at the 7 Mile Building in Juneau takes care of the capital projects and large maintenance projects. Marine Highway System, we handle smaller maintenance projects. We have a team that does that. Matt. Just a quick look at the Marine Highway. If you take a look, we've got an overlay of the United States. Of course, the state of Alaska is a very, very big state, and our system is quite large. And in essence, relatively speaking, would stretch from Tampa Bay all the way to the Midwest and the West Coast. And it's very different than probably 3 of the biggest systems in the United States. As you can see, we have a 3,500-mile route system. We carry approximately 340,000 passengers and 115,000 vehicles, as opposed to Washington State and BC Ferries that have much smaller systems. They have a much higher passenger volume. Those are mostly commuters, in essence. They do some tourist business, but a lot of that's commuters. They don't carry the same amount of vehicles. They do, but they're carrying them shorter distances. We're carrying fewer vehicles and people over a very, very long distance. So it's dynamically, we're very, very different than the other two big systems in the United States. This is a quick look at our passenger and vehicle traffic by year, by physical year, and it stays pretty consistent. As you can see, it is very high in July, and then it works down to a low point in January. That's when we have much less ships on. Starts working its way back up in April, and then right on so into June and July. Vehicles, less of a curve. but it does slowly bottom out a little bit in the wintertime, and then it slowly comes back. So the cars, in essence, stay more consistent than passenger ridership, per se. This chart here is an overview of two things. On-time departures, we gauge that by a ship sailing within 30 minutes of the published sailing time, and customer satisfaction. We do very well, in essence, with keeping the ships moving, and our customers are very happy. We are going to start a process of, you know, with our new reservation system, we'll have access to a lot more data. We're going to start a surveying process of, like, for example, hotels do. You stay in a hotel, you'll get an email with a questionnaire. And that is probably going to be much better for us because we can change that more easily electronically as opposed to having hard copies where passengers just fill out, you know, a form and we really can't change the questions that frequently. So we'll have a lot more ability to gather a lot more information on customer satisfaction, and we're working on that process now. To note on the bottom of this sheet, we built our online reservation system. We started that in 2005. That's where customers can actually go in and make reservations. We have gone from about 18.5% of those making online reservations to about 41% now in 2014.
If we could take a question from Senator Stedman. Yeah. I mean, Dunleavy.
To the chair, he's shorter. Quick question on one graph. I have a new Senate district, and I've got Whittier and Valdez, so I'm trying to get up to speed on the ferry system. Going back to your graph on page 8.
Okay.
As your passengers' numbers dip certain times of the year, are you still running the same ships with the same capacity?
Kevin Falvey through the chair, Senator Dunleavy. The service in essence gets reduced during the wintertime in general. We may not have two ships running in Prince William Sound per se, where we would have two vessels running in the summertime, or in the wintertime, there would be just one ship running there. So we slow the service down, in essence, to answer that question.
So you reduce ships or services. Is the capacity on those ships, do you have open seats, more open seats in the wintertime than you do in the summer?
Through the chair, Kevin Falvey, yes, Senator, yes.
And is there a practice to sell those seats at a discount to try and encourage more riders? Because you're going to be paying for that fuel and that cost anyway from one point to the other.
Kevin Falvey, through the chair, Senator. We, in essence, would struggle with that now due to the fact that the reservation system that we have is almost 20 years old, and it's not very robust. We plan to take a look at that with the new reservation system. It'll give us an ability to manage that much more readily. I know the airlines do that, and we know that. And we hope to have that new system on fully by this fall, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But that is something that we will have the ability to do. We really don't have the ability to do that right now.
Okay.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Yes, sir.
And I just wanted to also recognize that we have with us Representative Quito. Thank you for joining us. Please proceed.
Yes, sir. So we have slowly but surely had more reservations being made online, which requires, those calls into our call center. Okay, this chart in essence shows operating, expenditures analysis between FY 08 and 11. It's really a simple chart. The bottom blue shows the GF that we receive, and the top shows the revenue. If you look at FY 14, the $166 million is total cost. Fuel trigger money is embedded in there. So that's the total cost. Now, that does not include the what we call state GF capital that we also receive separately from this to conduct our annual state capital CIP overhauls on the ships. Every ship goes into an overhaul for 6 to 8 weeks. It's in essence twofold. We have a lot of certifications, equipment certifications, hull inspections, equipment inspection that has to happen on a yearly basis per federal regulations. And We also use this opportunity to do you know, minor maintenance. The federal CIP projects, the large projects, they are also separate from that, and that's federal money. You know, for example, the Kennecott is in the tail end of a 2-year. We broke it up into 2 years because it was a large project, about a $14 million overhaul project that's being done in Ketchikan last winter and this winter. So that funding is in essence separate, and that's where the major you know, renovations and upgrades to the ships are made. So that's in essence a little bit about the money. This slide shows costs in essence.
Sorry, if we could just hold for a quick second. We've got Representative Nagyak who has a question.
Yes, question.
Thank you. I just want to know what the you have the operating expenditure analysis, and what's a major cost driver of the the graph?
Through the chair, Kevin Favre, through the chair, Representative. We have that in a few more slides, so I can explain that in a few more slides, sir. Yeah, and I have a breakdown on a pie chart.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Okay, to keep going. Okay. This chart, in essence, is the question that you had, Representative, and it shows the $166 million for FY14 on the operating side, and then we break down the revenue. And you can see wages at 40% and payroll at 23%. Those are the two big drivers. Travel at 2%. That's crew and shoreside. We do travel some of the crew that have non-bid jobs on the ships. So there is some of that goes on. Services, that's at about 10%. We pay state risk management, broadband, which is up around $1 million just for the broadband so our satellite systems can communicate, terminal contracts, the subcontractors out in terminals, laundry, you know, we pay the prison to do our laundry, it's a large amount of laundry, things like that. Fuel, that's at about 19%. Commodities, that's supplies, equipment, supplies, things like that. Support services, the Marine Highway System does pay, you know, DOT admin, HRLR, Commissioner's Office, Southeast Region, the AG's Office, things of that nature. Over on the revenue side, the two, of course, drivers are ticket sales for passengers and the car deck. As you can see, the money is on the car deck at about 48%, and the passengers come in at about 33%. Stateroom and ticket sales, 10%. Passenger services sales, that's the things that we sell on the ship, food and whatnot, is 8%. And then interest on the money in our funds, that's another 1%. So does that answer your question, sir?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, sir. Okay, a quick look forward into 15. Our mantra at the Marine Highway System is to manage to our budget. We work very, very hard to manage to our budget, and we have been very successful at doing that for quite a few years now. To date, our traffic numbers have improved by 7%. You know, just a quick look from last year to this year. We've had very few casualties. We've had very few weather cancellations. Things are going really well considering the ships are old. We work really hard to keep them moving, and we do pretty well with that. We have implemented a tariff increase of 4.5%. Now, we're going to talk a little more about that in the next presentation, but very briefly, last year there was some legislative intent language regarding an increase of revenue, thus reducing needed GF, and so we did that. And there's been actually two studies lately. In 07 or 08, we did a rate study, and then now we've done the tariff study. So what we did learn from these studies is the first study, the rate study, we got a close look at our rates and our tariffs. Now, it's unbelievable, but the Marine Highway System has about 20,000 tariffs between every single combination of city, ship, kayak, 40-foot van, about 20,000. It's become unmanageable in essence, and with this older reservation system we have, it's really unmanageable. Thus, our new system and a new method the tariffs, which Matt's going to explain in a few minutes. But what we did was we did discover where the high tariffs are and where the low tariffs are, okay? And we know what city pairs they are. So embedded in the 4.5% was we isolated those tariffs, city pairs that are 25% higher than the norm, and we have frozen those, and we're working we're going to move slow here, but we're moving at a 4.5% rate this year to slowly start catching up so we can even the tariffs off. Our goal, as Matt will explain in the tariff study, is to create a situation where our tariffs are fair and equitable by the mile, so that everybody's in essence paying the same fare for miles of service. So that has been implemented. We've done that within the last few weeks. Reservations that are being taken now will take effect May 1st. That will generate about a $1.8 million savings in this budget coming up.
We've got a question from Senator Stedman.
Senator Stedman, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the new rate structure, one of the challenges I've run into as one of the frequent users of the Blue Canoes. For instance, if I want to get to Sitka and it happened to be a ferry from Petersburg to Sitka, I get on Petersburg Zip to Sitka. But if there's no stop in Sitka, I got to get routed up through Juneau, even though my destination is Sitka and I don't want to go to Juneau, because I come here more than I'd like, I think. anyway, how is the new fare structure treating that? Because as I recall, the fare that I'd pay would be as if I was going to Juneau and then from Juneau to Sitka. So it was quite a bit more expensive, even though it wasn't my fault.
Ken Felley, through the chair, Senator Stedman, I would like to have Matt McLaren answer that, because that's a good question. That's a very good question.
Matt McLaren, through the chair, Senator Stedman. That's something we have looked at very thoroughly with as we're currently working on the new system. The plan that we've decided to go with is look at the beginning port and ending port. We don't want to penalize somebody who has to go, say, through Juneau to get to Sitka just because there's no other choice. So the tariff will be the same as if they were just going Petersburg to Sitka. We'll just go by beginning port and ending port, and that's what the mileage and fare will be based on.
There's a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. One of the things is this isn't the first time that the Marine Highway, all departments are going to come under a pretty tight budget review this year, but Marine Highway will get wrapped up in the budget deficit that burdening the whole state. So with that, and thinking that that's probably the road we're going to be going down, do you have any of the data available for passengers that are no revenue? It could be state workers, could be state police, it could be military, it could be whoever's on the ship that's not paying the fare. So we have a breakdown of that. As government attractions.
Through the chair, Senator, in regards to passes and whatnot, mm-hmm. we've in essence eliminated that. We have stopped and I can talk a little bit about that, but that process in essence has been discontinued, passes in general. Right. Yeah.
Okay. And then, it was kind of a loaded question because we had that issue we dealt with several years ago, I think. I'd also like to hear in the presentation sometime about the efficiencies that the Marine Highway has aggressively gone after to try to practice cost controls, engines and propellers and all kinds of things that reduce the expenditure side, because I don't want it to go unnoticed, the effort that's been made to, even though for a new member looking at this, some of the numbers might be alarming. We've been trying to control these costs for several years.
Kevin Felby, through the chair, Senator, I would like to address that at the end of the presentation. I don't have that included in the presentation. We could provide that to you as a separate item, after this meeting. But I would like to at least discuss. We've very aggressively, done cost reductions, and I can get into that.
Okay. Senator Dunleavy.
Through
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up to that. I'm assuming, and maybe you can confirm, that the governor has reached out to you to get your group's view on what reductions could take place within the ferry system?
Okay, I'll get through the chair. You were in that process. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes.
Please proceed.
Yes, sir. So the 4.5% increase, that will generate approximately $1.8 million in reduced GF for this coming FY16. And so we feel quite confident that we could deliver that figure. The next one is our Alaska Class Ferry day boats that are currently being constructed in Ketchikan, two of them. These vessels will be 280 feet long, seat up to 300 passengers, carry 53 Alaska standard vehicles. That's in essence a Ford Expedition, a big Ford, 53 of them. It's going to feature very fast loading and unloading, bow and stern doors. Okay, we will have hopefully a new double stern berth facility in Haines by FY17, which will accommodate very rapid movement of the vehicles on and off. The car decks are enclosed. I know this body is very concerned about that over the last few years, as opposed to the open car decks. These will be enclosed car decks, so the cars will be protected from the seas and the spray. And there will be a lot of efficiencies. The new engines are very, very efficient. As we put here, controllable pitch propellers, the Rolls-Royce system, incredibly efficient, even for maneuvering and fuel efficiency. And what we have slated is for a 2018 delivery date, one vessel in the spring and one vessel in the fall. These vessels will work Lynn Canal shuttling between Juneau and Haines and Haines and Skagway. So right now, the project is well underway. We have purchased four engines. We were able to purchase the engines before January 1st. That allowed us to purchase what we call Tier 3 admission engines as opposed to Tier 4. It's an EPA requirement. Tier 4 engines would have been much more expensive to purchase, would have been much more costly to operate over the years because of the filtration systems that you need to have on these engines. And what we needed to do was cut 33,000 pounds of steel by January 1st to meet those EPA requirements, and we've done that. So the engines are purchased, paid for, stored in Ketchikan very safely, and we're rolling along. We're on budget and we're on time right now. So that's where we are with the Alaska Class Ferries.
We have a question from Representative Klayman and then Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, the day boat class ferries, where do they fit in the fleet composition, in the mainliners or the shuttles?
They will fit in the third category under the day vessels. They'll be day vessels. The crews will go home to Juneau at night and Skagway at night. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes.
For the chair, the total cost of each of these vessels is how much?
Total cost was we had $120 million to start with. We did start with a larger version of one vessel. That was a 350-foot ship. We got through a certain part of that design and realized that we couldn't deliver that 350-foot ship for $120 million. That process was stopped. We stopped at about a $3.5 million expenditure. We have that design. That design is ours. It's archived. If we ever did have the need to build a vessel like that again, we would have a good running head start on the design. So it's not money lost, not money wasted. It's ours. And the remainder of the money, approximately $117.5 million, is what we had to do the design, do the engineering, construction engineering, indirect cost allocation, and construction. And that was about $117.5 million. And that's what we'll deliver the two ships for, and we're on track so far.
117 each?
No, for two.
Total for 117
yes,
million. And
yes,
the capacity, the passenger capacity?
300 passengers, each. 53 large vehicles each. Yes,
okay,
sir.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Were there any other questions? Senator Sibb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick follow-up on that. The cost of repowering the Columbia, the engines, so maybe you could just mention that just for...
I'm going to mention that at the end, Senator, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And if possible, we're already 5 minutes
on time. I'm almost done.
We still need to get to the tariff section, so maybe if you could kind of summarize on this part.
Really quick. Really quick. We are building a new reservation system. We will have that delivered, in essence, fully being used by the public by next October. We will have it up online, in essence, where we're going to run parallel with the old system from July to October in case there are bugs or things that aren't working quite right. So we have it covered both ways. The company that is delivering this project for us is called Chorus. They're a company from Finland. They are very versed in reservation systems for companies just like the Marine Highway system. There are many operators in the Baltic, the UK, Europe, Africa, Australia, the Med, that operate just like we do, row, passengers, cabins, cars, freight, in essence, much bigger operations and much bigger ships, and they are very successful. And to date, they've done a tremendous job, and we are very confident that they're gonna deliver a really nice product for us. And there's going to be a lot of efficiencies with the new system. It's going to be much more user-friendly. Hopefully it is comparable to anything Alaska Airlines has out there. It's going to be more user-friendly for the customer. It's going to create a lot more efficiencies as far as, being able to use your smartphones for, scanning. It's going to help us with security, with passengers on and off as far as tracking them. We will eventually have kiosks just like Alaska Airlines has. We will have a much easier time tracking our customers, so marketing will have an easier time creating outreach and whatnot. So we really feel that by next fall we will have a world-class reservation system that is going to be a very efficient system for us. Through the chair, Mrs. Kevin Falvey, Senator Stebbins, I know you had asked about just some cost savings measures. Over the last 2 years, not including this year, we have reduced costs by about $4.5 million. We have reduced travel agent commissions. We at one point had well over 300 travel agents that we were paying 10% commissions to for any kind of a sale. We were paying travel agents to sell tickets from Ketchikan to Metlakatla. I mean, that kind of thing, we don't need help with that. What we need is travel agents that can bring in business from the outside. So what we did was we reduced commissions on point-to-point in-state Alaska, travel in-state for in essence, Alaska citizens, and that saved us $450,000. We reduced round-trip discounting, the 30% round-trip discounting we had. We've reduced that in the wintertime. We've discontinued, driver goes free type plans. There's another $450,000. And we still have the winter driver goes free. We have closed the gift shops on the ships. No employees lost jobs. We repositioned those gift shop employees into other jobs, and we just hired less new employees for the summer season. We hire between 75 and 100 new employees every year because we lay up half the fleet, we lose a lot of the passenger services staff, and then we start all over again this time of year rehiring. So that just helped us not have to hire as many employees. So in essence, it was about $1 million savings. We did reduce the running time of the Taku. We reduced her running time by a month. That saved us about $1 million. And the Latuya, because we have the Annette Bay terminal that is much closer than the Port Chester terminal to Ketchikan, we've cut the running time in half. We've been able to still have two runs a day, and we save fuel. We have the crew working a nine-hour day. It's about a $200,000 savings. We did push one of the fast ferries back by 4 or 5 months instead of coming out in February. We came out in May. That did save us about $800,000. We've eliminated outsourcing. We had $200,000 on our budget if we needed, say, Allen Marine, or we needed to bring someone in if we had issues between Homer and Saldovia, which we did with the Kennecott with one of the loading doors. We've eliminated that. We're watching overtime as best we can between our shoreside staff and our shipboard staff. We've gotten down into things like saving $40,000 on cell phones. Believe it or not, Marine Highway System runs 24/7. We have cell phones with shoreside staff, shipboard staff, terminal staff. We've gotten into a stipend system, and we've worked out a very nice plan with AT&T, and it saved us about $40,000. As far as engines, the Columbia has just received new engines. She was in Portland Shipyard last year for about nine months. Two brand new engines, federal money. That was not state money. It was a $32 million job. Those engines now are saving about 10% on fuel because of the new engines. The Fast Ferry engines, the Fairweather has four new engines. Some of the members may know we've had a lot of trouble with those engines. We have MTU 4000 engines in there now. Fairweather's running very nicely at about a 10% savings because they burn a lot of fuel, new engines. The Chinook is getting her engines as we speak. This was a settlement that the state had with MTU, no cost to us. This was about another $30, $35 million settlement. We have two spare swing engines in Ketchikan that we were able to purchase at, in essence, half price, training, parts, things like that. So in essence, we made out pretty well there. We do have fuel management systems on the mainline ships, much like an Alaska airline jet has throttle control systems. They save about 5% in fuel. And we will be repowering the Matanuska, one of our mainline ships, in 16 and 17. And we feel that's going to create quite a bit of fuel savings also.
Senator Egan's got a question, and then Representative
Mr. Chair. Captain, that's what we get for buying engine serial number one and two. Anyway, can you update us on Prince Rupert?
The Prince Rupert terminal?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we're working on Prince Rupert. We're in a situation in Prince Rupert where we are attempting to rebuild the dock there. Okay, if I go back in history in time just a little bit, about 6 years ago, that dock was in essence condemned. I got a call at 3 o'clock in the afternoon by city officials in Prince Rupert and said, "Don't come back here. We've just done a survey of the dock and it's not safe." So very, very quickly, we worked a deal with BC Ferries, which is right next door to our terminal, to dock our ships there. That we had to scramble to do that, but we did that. That's not available to us anymore because that is a new dock and our ships don't fit there. So that card's out of the deck. But 2 years ago, we signed a 50-year lease with Prince Rupert and, in essence, the Crown and the Canadian government. That was a $3.3 million a lump sum down payment. That was federal dollars. It was not state dollars. We, in essence, we're leasing for 50 years, but in essence, we own the terminal. Technically, that's our terminal. We pay property taxes there. We do the maintenance there, and our intent was to spend between $11 and $20 million, again of federal money, to rebuild the dock, because the dock does need to be rebuilt eventually. And we've gotten into a dilemma with Federal Highway Buy American rules that basically say if you're going to use federal dollars, you need to buy the steel. Now this is just the steel, not the labor. That would have been Canadian labor building the dock, but the steel that goes into the dock has to be American. And what the Canadians then did was they didn't think that was a very good thing for Canada, and they invoked something called the Foreign Extraterritorial Measures Act. And what that basically did was put the word out to any Canadian bidders, should you bid on this, big fines are out there and potentially other things are out there for you if you bid on this. So yesterday, the state withdrew the bid, and that's where we're at right now, Senator.
Great, thank you.
Representative Hughes and then Stutes.
Thank you. Thank you. I hesitated asking a question because I am eager to get on to some more things that are coming up in this hearing. But on the other hand, perhaps this question might whet our appetites and be a good segue into what we'll be talking to in a little bit. And I'll preface my question by stating that when I first came up to Alaska as a teenager, I lived in Hoonah. And I realize how important ferries are to the communities in these parts. And I still have family in Hoonah and lots of family here in Juneau as well. But on the other hand, you know, as we all know, we are hitting tight times when it comes to budget, and a great amount of state subsidy has been going into the ferry system at the tune of, I believe, $120 million just in this last fiscal year. So my question to you is, looking ahead, what is the department thinking about how to bring those costs down as has been done in places like Norway and in Canada, where they've really worked to supplement where they've previously been point A and point B have been tied together solely by ferry, where they're adding tunnels and bridges and roads and other things. So I'm just wondering the long-term vision and what the department is thinking at this point about that. Thank you.
Well, that's a good question. Captain Falvey, through the chair, Representative, some of the issues we have, you know, if you were to go back to the pie chart on page 11, is the two biggest drivers, that being wages and fuel, okay? And, you know, the wages are, in essence, you know, the wages of the staffs running the vessels. We are negotiating those contracts. We are working through that process, trying to become as efficient as we can with the marine contracts, you know, and of course, fair and equitable and efficient. And fuel's a big driver, you know, and as far as the fuel goes, new engines in the ships, we're seeing about a 10% reduction in fuel. We burn about 11 million gallons of fuel a year, and on the ships with the new engines, we're seeing about a 10% reduction. Our throttle management systems, our fuel management systems, we're seeing reductions there, and all the mainliners, you know, have these systems aboard. So those are the two really big ones, and you know, fuel, we're trying to manage it as best we can, and we're doing the best we can to manage wages. You know the rest of it, it's pretty hard.
Yeah, and I do appreciate that effort to bring cost savings wherever you can, although I don't think the things that you just mentioned are to the degree of what is being done in other places where there are ferry systems. So I just want to encourage the department to continue to think of that. We hear about the word sustainability when it comes to budgets, responsible budgets, and I believe there's more work to be done, and we have to do some more out-of-the-box thinking and think about bringing together different modes of transportation to bring down the costs.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that being from Kodiak, my interest was piqued, and I didn't hear you mention the Tusty or the potential replacement of the Tusty, as well as the repairs on the docks, which got put back for another year due to the sea lion issue, and I'm wondering how that's going to affect the projected costs of those repairs that were going to be made in Kodiak.
Kevin Falvey through the chair, Representative. Yes, the new Tusty, I did not mention that. We are designing away we're designing the new Tustamina. We are projecting to have that design completed by this December or maybe into the early spring. We do have $10 million of design money. I don't believe we're going to need all that, so we are designing. We still have approximately $50 million in the fund, and we're assuming that the new ship will be, you know, somewhere in the range of $220 million to build. So that's in essence where the new Tustamina is.
If I may.
Hold on.
Thank you. Let's see. I lost my train of thought.
Well, and on the dock, that's more of a DOT Southeast Region a question. You know, DOT Southeast Region is they're the party that's doing the dock renovation, and we did have an issue with you know, sea lion permits, and we are very, or they are very quickly working through the process to get those permits in place, and we will as soon as we get the permit set and we get the construction window, then we'll get building again. So
as a follow-up, I hear you say that the design is work in the process on the Testamina, on the new Testamina, and it seems like this Testamina is 50 years old and it's been pretty serviceable, and I guess my question to you is, because I don't understand it totally, are we reinventing the wheel here by spending all that money on design? It just seems a little bit like maybe we're stepping
back. Probably through the chair. No, that's a good question. You know, the original Testamina is getting old, and these ships do have a service life, and we need to be cognizant of that. I feel professionally, in my professional opinion, I have been in this business a very long time, running ships as a captain, and many, many years before I ever got here to the state of Alaska. We have another 10 years or so of service life with the current Testamina. We do keep these ships, in essence, running, all of them, through the major federally sponsored CIP projects. You know, as you know, we just had a very large project with the Testamina at Seward Shipyard, and we ran into some issues with the shipyard. That had no reflection on the ship being in bad condition. There were issues with the shipyard, okay? But we still got a good overhaul. We did a lot of good repairs to the ships, and I believe professionally that ship, you know, has another 10 years of life. But it would be remiss not to start the process of thinking about a new one. Now we are going through the design process. In essence, I'm taking two tracks, one where I can use state money or federal money. There's another process. If you're going to use federal money, we're also going down that trail too. So we could use state money, federal money, or a combination thereof to get to where we need to be. And it's just a matter of being proactive. The old ship won't last forever, and we think it's the right thing to do to start designing a new one. And we're well along into that process.
Thank you.
Yes.
Senator Stidman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on a follow-up on cost containment, I guess one of the more radical cost containment avenues we can do is just tie the ships to the dock. And in doing so, does that incur costs, or all costs just go to zero if you tie the fleet up and the subsidy disappears?
Captain Fabi, through the chair. No, the cost would not go to zero, Senator Stedman. The only way the cost would go to zero is if we surplused or scrapped the ship. We would still, you know, have to, in essence, look after it. You know, risk management would, there'd be a certain degree of risk management. You know, if you wanted to keep the ship in any kind of a ready status, you would have to keep the certificates up to date, things like that. So there is always a cost associated just to leave one of these ships at the dock. Matt, I don't know if we've looked at, you know, the cost to do that. I think we've got ideas on numbers, you know, if that becomes an option.
Just as a follow-up, it's just the point of the question wasn't, you know, are you going to tie the boat up and the subsidy goes to zero, because I know that doesn't work that way. The question is probably, well, I didn't put it as well as I should have. In the event you decide to tear up or tie up one or more ships, there's a lot of embedded costs, so that ship cost doesn't go to zero. There's some percentage of revenue loss, and you've got a significant other bunch of costs that you have to facilitate. So it's not as easy as just picking one or two of the old ships and tying them to the dock and bring your subsidy down. I think what both committees will find is this is extremely complex. You have union agreements in place. We don't have the ability unilaterally to just do anything we want.
No.
So it's a challenging problem, and that's why over the last several years, probably about the last eight, there's been significant amount of pressure put on Marine Highway for efficiency increases.
Senator Michiki.
Captain Falvey, just a quick one here. First of all, I wanted to, my last district was dependent on the services of the Testamina. I know the loss of service for a bit was frustrating to everyone involved and to your team as well. So thanks for the way you management and for your unprecedented safety record and delivering Alaskans. The governor asked for two different scenarios on potential cuts. And this follows up a little bit on Representative Hughes' question, but when you're looking at efficiencies, did rates, schedules, service adjustments come into consideration, or is that something that you may look into in the future?
Captain Falvey, through the chair, as we move forward, yes, we are looking at those sort of things.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Clayman.
Thank you. Through the chair, follow up on Representative Stewart's question. In terms of design, I guess I can best analogize it to the auto industry, that we could go and design the latest whiz-bang fancy car and roll out the new version, and then the other side of it is, well, we could go and buy a take the design from the 10-year-old pickup truck that's been doing really well and kind of putting it in those terms. I just wonder sometimes why are we, my sense from having ridden many of the ferries that for the most part we're not really looking at ferries that necessarily need to be the cutting edge of technology. And so I'm curious why we're spending so much on the design when it would seem like, especially something like the Testamina, there's probably some very good designs that have been built and working very effectively in other parts of the world. And why are we spending so much to kind of reinvent the wheel? And that's kind of a follow-up on it, but that was my sense of what Representative Stewart was
saying. Through the chair, Kevin Falvey, Representative. No, that's a very good question. The routes that the Testamina run are very unique in that we don't own most of the docks. You have huge tides running everywhere from Kodiak all the way down the chain. That forces us into a vehicle elevator type situation. Very unusual, as far as operating. Even worldwide, you don't tend to see that. You tend to see floating docks that go up and down with the ships, because the docks that these companies run to, they either own or they have arrangements where they've got floating docks. So being that these docks are not ours, we need a ship that can accommodate everything, every dock we go to. So the old Testamina is a very good design, okay? And we've taken a lot of that. We've looked very closely at that. Our naval architect firm is looking very closely at that. But, when you take that basic design, and that's really what we've done, we've worked very hard to build efficiencies into that. Everything from hull efficiencies, propeller efficiencies, with computer graphics now, thousands and thousands of hull forms.
Well, actually, to cut you off through the chair, it sounds like what you're saying is that this is a very, very unique ship, and that if you wander the world, you won't find another
one.
Not
going to find another one like it.
So we're either talking about improving on the Testamina or starting from scratch.
Well, I think another thing we need to be...
You're essentially starting with the Testamina.
We are absolutely starting with the Testamina. We've made the new Testamina a little bigger. This is, as we held public meetings, because we did that, I went on the road for almost 2 weeks holding public meetings. Kodiak, I went all the way out as far as Dutch Harbor and sat down with the communities. What do you folks need? And they needed more capacity. They wanted more capacity for vans. So we needed a ship that was a little bit bigger, but we can't have a ship that's too big, because then you won't be able to get into all the ports down the chain. This is the problem we had when the old Tustamina got hung up for a year in the sewage shipyard, the Kennecott, which is able to go, couldn't fit into the dock. So it's a very unique ship. And
I think you've answered the question.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So our plan was we had hoped to get through the overview and the tariff study by 1:30. It's 2 o'clock right now. The tariff is very important. It was a part of the operating budget that be reported on this year, and so I don't want to overly speed it up, but if we can get to the meat of the matter on that, and we do have folks who have flown in for the second half of our meeting to discuss the mega project, so we wanted to also give them time to talk about that. So if you could address the tariff, and then if we could just hold the questions until the end of that presentation. Thank you.
Okay. Matt McLaren, through the chair, we'll try to hit the main points here and in the interest of time, get through it very quickly. So the agenda, Northern Economics did the tariff study for us, and they've given us recommendations of what they have found in the industry, what other similar ferry systems do with their tariff structures, and other transit agencies, airlines, bus systems, and other transportation companies. So they made recommendations on formulas that we set up some kind of tariff formula for the different types of service that we offer. And then we'll touch briefly on what our plan is for the tariffs moving forward. So to begin with, their first recommendation they gave us when they looked at all of our tariffs, they found that our tariffs for passengers, vehicles, cabins ranged significantly, and there are quite a bit of differences in tariffs by nautical mile and difference in regions. So their recommendation was that we take a look at the average tariff per nautical mile, and those tariffs that we found that were above 25% above the average tariff, that we freeze those tariffs and we don't make any changes to those, don't increase those at all at this time. So the second, they recommended adopting a formula approach to set in our tariffs so that we could be more equitable throughout the system, implementing that. And the third thing was to set a two-tiered tariff approach so with some seasonal adjustments that we could adjust the tariffs to meet the demand of the summer season and winter season. They recommended passenger tariffs should be 0 to 30% higher in the summer months and 30 to 40% higher in the summer for vehicles. The reason they recommended 0 to 30% starting at zero was so that we could look at those routes that maybe in the summer months the demand doesn't really change much from winter. Some of the communities that we have a lot of local traffic, the demand's going to be is fairly steady throughout the year. There's not a lot of tourist traffic going there, so that gives us the ability that we to not increase those tariffs in the summer months. The recommended fare box recovery, they recommended we set that between 39% and 65%. We are currently, the last few years, we've been recovering about 31%. That's been pretty consistent for the last 5 years. So there would need to be some increases there so that we would get either more efficiencies to reduce our costs and a combination of tariffs to get to that 39% to 65% recovery rate. The next one was to differentiate between commercial traffic and passenger vehicle traffic. Currently, we don't differentiate between the two. We just look at our car deck space and what each takes up, how much room each takes up. So what they found is in the industry, commercial transport companies, transporting vans, things like that, that that in the industry out there, most of them are higher for the commercial traffic. And so they recommended 60 to 120% increase there. They also recommended adding a premium for high demand routes, where we get a lot of traffic, we're close to our capacity on those, and for dedicated routes, express routes, that we run consistently. So and the last recommendation they had there, you can see from a lot of the recommendations, there could be some pretty significant increases. Their recommendation, we implement those gradually over time so that we don't shock the system and shock those areas who maybe their tariffs are quite a bit below average right now. So move on to the passenger tariff formula, just to give you an idea, a quick idea of what would go into that. They recommended setting an embarking, disembarking fixed fee, and then adding a distance-based fee into that. And as we talked about, the seasons and, you know, summer, winter, and the route types, express, et cetera, those would also be factored in to come up with the passenger tariff. Vehicles would be similar, with the exception of there'd be a dimensional adjustment for some wide vehicles that may take up extra space on the car deck that limits what we can park next to that vehicle. And then we'd add also a commercial fee so we could make that adjustment to commercial traffic as opposed to passenger vehicles. Cabin tariffs, similar recommendation there on the formula. Cabin types, whether it's two berth, three berth, four berth, inside, outside, there'd be different rates for those for the cabin type. Distance fee there included also, and we'd also look at a seasonal adjustment and a route type adjustment. This is just a sample table on this slide that gives what we looked at for those tariffs that were above 25% above our average tariff. You can look at some of the links there with our passenger rates in the first column. Annette Bay to Ketchikan, a lot of that is due to the short distance there. When we're looking at the average per nautical mile, it's I believe only 8 miles, so, you know, the average is quite a bit higher there, but we'd be able to bring that more in line with the averages also. So these are some of the tariffs when we implemented the 4.5%. These were all fares that were frozen. We did not increase these at all. As we increase the low tariffs, it helps bring these high ones a little closer into the average just by increasing the low ones. Our plan moving forward is to continue to keep the high tariffs frozen until we increase the lower ones and help make those more fair and equitable throughout the system. We have implemented the 4.5% across the board while we froze the high ones, and we plan to look forward, look at all our routes to determine which routes would have the demand there that a seasonal adjustment would be appropriate. We of course a lot more traffic in the summer. Tourism, a lot of that traffic coming in the summertime. So we look at those routes affected by that. The next thing we'll look at which routes are express routes, dedicated routes, which ones are highly utilized, so we can determine what are to, you know, charge a premium on those routes. We will be implementing the formula approach, and even with the formula, we're going to look at still at tariffs. We're going to have to implement that gradually. If we apply the formula system-wide now, there would potentially be some large increases in certain areas. So we don't want to, like I said, we don't want to shock the system. We would determine a way that we can gradually implement that over several years. So it'll take a little bit of time to get everything fair and equitable, but that's the direction we're going.
Thank you, Mr. McLaren. Are there any questions of the committee? No questions.
And Mr. Chair, also, I think it's important to know that we're working on the actual formulations now. We're in the process of calculating the tariff, so that is happening. I mean, these were the recommendations that we received from Northern Economics. We feel they're right on. And we're working on that formulation now. And as we develop the new reservation system, we will have this new tariff system, hopefully, as our plan, embedded into it when we go totally live next fall. That's what we're doing. And we're actually working on that now. We're doing the formulations.
Great. Going once. Representative Coleman.
Thank you, through the chair. One of the things I've heard from some constituents is at times, at least within Prince William Sound, a feeling that kind of schedule inflexibility, that there'll be local events going on, events in Cordova, sometimes events in Valdez, in which people are communicating with the Marine Highway System to try to take advantage of opportunities to get more people on the ferries, and there seems, and I hear consistently, kind of an inflexibility of recognizing local events that the Marine Highway System could make some minor adaptations to the schedule and take advantage of those, both to get Alaskans on the ferry but actually capture revenue on those events. Is there any progress on being a little more flexible with schedule to respond to local events? I mean, Kodiak might be at Crab Festival, again, another instance in which flexibility would help.
Yeah, Captain Thumby, through the chair, our representative. We actually do work very hard at trying to accommodate the events. We do a summer a teleconference and a winter a teleconference. We have a full-time scheduler, and she is very skilled, very talented. Making this system all work is incredibly complex. We have a comment period on all of the, like, say, for example, the draft summer schedule that's going to come out. We have a multiple-week comment period. We take email comments. She receives a lot of phone calls. We have a teleconference. And we have a laundry list of special events, right down to, the festivals in Cordova and the festivals in Haines and the school children with their tournaments and the gold medal and 500 kids coming down to Ketchikan this year for the music fest. We honestly do try very hard to do that. We have some issues at times in the winter if there's a fast ferry running up there and we get some weather delays. But if we're on a 4-day schedule, I authorize.
I'm hearing all these as late spring, summer, and early fall. Not much winter.
Well, we do accommodate as best we can. The requests that we get. And we're aware of that.
Mr. Chairman.
We have a question from Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to take the time here to mention that since Captain Falvey's come on board, the amount of times my phone rings with complaints and issues with the Marine Highway has dropped precipitously over the last several years. There's a huge difference. In fact, it rings very seldom anymore with complaints from the public. So even though we're going to be struggling with some budget issues that we can't avoid, there's been huge improvements in the Marine Highway System in the last several years. I just don't want that to go unnoticed by those that don't frequent it as much as the people that live on the islands that rely on it.
Senator, thank you very much. And it's my staff. I have an incredibly hardworking, skilled staff. And it isn't just the central office, the ships do an incredible job too. Those crews do a great job out on those ships, and they're out there docking in Ketchikan on nights when it was blowing 50 last night, and they're doing it safely. We do about 15,000 dockings and undockings a year. They do it safely. They're very skilled, and they're very good at what they do, and they do provide good customer service, as we can see from the customer satisfaction. But it's, I've got a very good team that works for me, and I got to give them the credit. Thank you.
Question from Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Mr. McLaren. Just reviewed the parts of the Northern Economic Study, and we talk about the upward trend and the longer distances of kind of the differential between the Alaska Marine Highway System and the 2014 highs. There's a 350% difference. Mm-hmm. When you look at a difference like that, your slide says that all tariff changes will be implemented gradually. Could you sort of define gradually with the current spending issues that we're having?
Yes, Ben McLaren, through the chair, Senator. We gradually, it's our plan is we expect it to be 4 to 5 years. We haven't detailed. It's going to depend a little bit on what the formula percentages, you know, the route cost per mile, embarking fee, which we're still working on ironing out those details of what each will be. We don't expect to make, when we say gradually, I would expect 4 to 5 years before we can get things that are really close to equitable throughout the system. As the higher tariffs are frozen, we're increasing the lower ones. It helps bring that average overall a little bit closer together. But, you know, if we're looking at hitting that 39% fare box recovery rate, that's in quick numbers, figuring it up, that's about a $13 million difference from where we are now to get to that point. So that $13 million either needs to come from efficiencies, reducing our costs, or, you know, getting that much more revenue, which we expect will be a combination of the two. So over the next 4 to 5 years, I expect we'll be consistent with that as far as doing that gradually. If we do it too much quicker than that, you know, just in rough numbers that we've played around with different scenarios with formulas, you know, some areas may end up with twice what their fare is right now. If it's a $20 fare, it may go to $40, but it may not seem like much, but doubling the tariff is a big deal. So we don't want to do big percentages each year.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
I just have a comment. As we're all talking about budget and efficiencies and everything, as you're still working on your budget, just on your pie chart on your first slide, Captain Falvey, and while your counterparts in DOT are sitting here in the room too, I'd like to see you guys go back and try to negotiate down your internal rate between the two departments, your support services. That's all.
The $2.4 million.
Yes.
Senator?
Just a comment.
Yes, sir.
Well, I thank you very much for your time. This has been a very interesting and engaging portion of our meeting here, and so, again, appreciate your time. And we're going to take a quick 10-second at ease while we exchange the gavel with Senator Senator. Representative Hughes, I gave her a promotion. And if we could also have the next presenters come up, please. At ease.
I'm calling the Joint Committee, Transportation Committee, back to order, please. So that was a good start, and we can dedicate time in the future. I believe we could have spent more time on that one, and with what's left on the agenda, we could easily go into the evening. We won't do this. We have been given a permission to use the room for an extra 30 minutes. If you have to leave it at 3 o'clock, we will understand that, and we will move along. We will have to really shorten up our time with each. We are going to hear from the various agencies regarding the six projects that were listed in the Governor Walker's Administrator Order 271. And I might mention there are little problems with BASIS right now, so these documents aren't on there yet, but as soon as BASIS is up and working properly, we'll get all that uploaded. And I want to start by saying I believe in our hearing notice, and actually even on the House floor, I referred to these six projects as mega projects, and I would like to withdraw that, because I've really thought about them and thought about them in comparison to, instance, the Alaska LNG project and even projects throughout the United States. These are not mega projects. These are major projects. They're important projects. But I really believe the word mega projects has been used incorrectly and perhaps even as a way to make it look like something that we shouldn't be moving forward. And so I just want to put that in perspective. For instance, it's no secret I come from the Mat-Su area, and so the Kinnickarm Crossing is one that's of great interest to my constituents and the residents in that area. That project is around $1 billion, plus or minus, and there are bridges in other parts. The one between Portland and Vancouver, for instance, that's a $3 billion bridge. We know what happened in Ketchikan when we label something a bridge to nowhere, it can kill a project. So I just want to set the stage there that these are major and important projects, but let's remember they're truly not on the scale of a mega project. And so with that, we're going to actually go through them in the order that they were listed in the administrative order, and that first one was the Ambler Mining District. And so do we have who is going to present? Oh, okay, Mark Davis, the Deputy Director. Ada, Deputy Director, is on the phone. I saw him in the building the other day, so I thought he was going to be here in person. I apologize. And so I think because we're so short on time on each of these projects, I suggest I think what everyone around the table and in the room will be interested in is the status, how much we've spent, what's going to happen with the federal funding, those very main high points. And then I'm going to be not quite as nice as my co-chair, Representative Foster, because I'm going to really hold the questions to the end of each of these. We won't wait till the very end, but we'll let Mark do his presentation. So hold your questions till Mark is done, and then we'll hit those questions so that we can try to stay on track the best we can with a little bit of time that we have left. So, Mark, if you could go ahead and begin by putting your name on the record, please.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. My name is Mark Davis. I'm the Deputy Director of ADA, and I want to thank the committee for letting me appear telephonically. In response to the order for status, ADA has issued stock orders, and we are in the process of paying off the outstanding invoices, and we are trying to manage those invoices to a minimum. So we're going through a process of determining what we can do to stabilize the data that's been collected to date on the road project, but not go to, a final report. So, for example, on the fisheries report, we believe we can expend $20,000 for a draft report versus a final report for $70,000. So we're going through that process. The road itself was not a complete project. ADA was always intending to use the appropriated funds only for the obtained an environmental impact statement. And so the monies we have left, we've told OMB, the appropriate funds are about $9.9 million, 9.7, and we've estimated that would cost approximately $1.4 to $1.6 million to shut down the project if that was the desire of the administration and the legislature. For an overview of what we've done so far, we've been collecting the base data, and we had prepared a draft application to the Corps of Engineers, and we had selected a third-party contractor that would have prepared an EIS if we had gone forward. And we estimate that if we kept the appropriated funds, we'd need about $6.8 to $7 million to continue toward a record of decision on EIS. Or if we shut down, we could return approximately $7.6 to $7.9 million back to the legislature. And that would probably be the end of my testimony.
That is a record for being very tight. So could you, really quick, was it 1.4 to shut down, 7 million more needed to continue, and then if you shut it down, it would cost to shut down, but there'd also be 7.9 coming back to the legislature?
So approximately $1.4 to $1.6 million to shut down. That would be to preserve the data, Madam Chair, so that we don't lose the data collected, and so that it goes in reports that could be used in the future if that was the desire. And that would mean that we could give the appropriation funds about $7.6 to $7.9 million back into the general fund. Or if we wanted to proceed forward, our budget, we think we need $6.8 million more to go forward, and we wouldn't need that money probably until FY17.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to ask, just because you are so compact, could you just give us a really quick overview of what the Ambler Mining District Road is? It's a 220-mile industrial road, correct? It's not paved. It would be gravel. And then tell us when, as far as the timeline of if we were to move forward, when would construction begin and end, those kind of things, very quickly.
Certainly. As I said, what ADA is working on was to obtain a record of decision on an environmental impact statement. And if we filed that for an EIS, it would take approximately 3 to 4 years to obtain the EIS. If the EIS were granted by the Corps of Engineers, then the Board of ADA would declare the project, and then we would go through the development of a finance plan and seek private capital together with ADA capital to build a road at an approximate cost of $200 million to $258 million, according to Dow Construction. And construction would take 3 to 4 years, so whole process is probably about 8 years out.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank you, Mark, for being very concise. So now we'll open up to questions. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might have missed it. How much money has the state invested to this point on the Ambler Road project?
It's approximately $20 million. Some of that was spent by DOT and some has been spent by ADA. ADA has received two appropriations from the legislature. And of that appropriation, we have approximately $9.3 million left.
Thank you. And Representative Nagyak.
I don't have a question. I think I have a statement, if that's okay. For the past couple of years, at least during my tenure here, I've been talking about access to resources and access to cheaper costs to get back and forth to oil and gas, or the cost of doing business is so high in rural Alaska especially, and so the drivers of those the high cost of living in rural Alaska is transportation costs, and case in point, I live 150 miles from the source of the wealth of the state, and I pay $7 a gallon for gasoline. And it's a whole lot more than it is in other villages. And we are one horse town in the state because we're dependent on most of the money coming from one source, that's oil and gas. And that's been driving this economy for a very long time. I think we need to start thinking and talking about getting more dependent on other resources. There's so many other resources, but they live in rural Alaska. And the only way to get there is by building ports, by building roads and other infrastructure. And so I just want to make sure that that departments understand that when especially the governor, the resources that we have are very important to the state. They can be the next revenue source for the state of Alaska. And this other project, the same thing. Every time we want to advance something that will make it easier and to cost less, to bring goods to to Alaska and from Alaska to the villages. It seems like every time we start talking about those, we shut off. And the projects are we're talking about today's dollars. Today's dollars are cheaper than tomorrow's dollars. We stop these projects, they're going to cost a whole lot more next year, year after year. And that's going to drive the project. Let's start building this infrastructure now at today's cost. And because the more we wait, the more we halt these projects, it's going to cost a whole lot more. So I just want to send a message to the people who are doing the state's business on our behalf and the departments, and especially the people who run the state. Say, think about things before you do things, because it's going to cost a whole lot more in the future than they do now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nagyak. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think it's difficult to, represent a community or a region and see a project, a large capital project, disappear when you're running surpluses, like the bridge to Gravina Island. Most of that money ended up in the rail belt. Very little was left in Southeast when the federal funds were spread around. But in these times, when we're going to be underwater $4 billion, something's got to give somewhere. I've been a supporter of that bridge for Enrob Road, Ambler Road, the Kinnickarm Bridge, most of these big projects for years. The Watonna Dam sat at this table when we did the original appropriations, kicked that off. It's going to be tough to see some of these projects go on the back burner for a while. Something's got to give, because $4 billion.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mark, hey, this is Click. What's the annual dividend to ADA on the Red Dog Port Road, and what's the dividend payment to NANA?
Senator Bishop, to the chair, I am not aware of the actual numbers, but I know that it's a significant revenue to ADA, and I can certainly get you that information. We have calculated the net present value of this road if it went forward. So it would be approximately, over the 30-year life, about $84 million to $90 million in net present value. Back to the developer.
Hey, are there other questions for Mr. Davis? Thank you very much for being with us. And these are tough times and tough decisions. And yet at the same time, I'll just make the comment, as we bring things down as far as the government, we want our private sector to be strong. If there's a chance that state employees might not have their jobs, it'd be nice if the private sector is in good shape to take them. So these are tough things. We're going to have to balance this out and figure out. And I will say, too, that the review, the governor's order, was to review them so that they could be prioritized. And I hope that we all keep a good open mind to that whole process and not be starting off in a set way off the bat. I know we all have our preferences and the projects that we like, but we really have to look at this from a statewide perspective. So thank you, and we'll next move to the Juneau Access Road project. And at the table, I'll allow those to introduce themselves and put your names on the record, please.
Afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Binder. I'm the Acting Commissioner for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
And for the record, my name is Kim Rice. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Surface Transportation.
DOT and PF does have two of the projects today, the Juneau Access and Kinnickarm Crossing. We'll cover Juneau Access right now. Juneau Access is a proposed Federal Highways Administration and DOT and PF action to improve surface transportation to and from Juneau within the Lynn Canal Corridor. As has been mentioned several times already today, this is quite an old project, been going on for quite some time. As far as the status goes, back in 2006, a final EIS was issued that would have allowed things to continue there regarding the East Lynn Canal Highway alternative for construction. However, following that action, there were several lawsuits that took place arguing that the EIS was invalid for failing to consider what improved service, ferry service could be made available using current infrastructure. After many days in court, that lawsuit was upheld, forcing everybody to go back and look again. So back in January of 2012, a supplemental EIS process was initiated to consider that additional alternative. Where we are now is in November of last year, 2014, a draft EIS, final EIS, was issued regarding that alternative as well. So that went out for public comment. We received a great number of those, and that's currently where we're at right now, is with the contractor responding to all of those comments, and that will take quite some time. We're anticipating that the draft final EIS will be available for record of decision sometime in early 16, so anticipating a good chunk of this year being spent responding to those comments and incorporating those into the EIS. And that's where we sit right now as of the governor's administrative order. As far as funding amounts, the estimated total cost for this project as of right now in 2013 dollars is about $570 million. So far, there's been approximately $26 million expended of federal funds. State fund amount is approximately $20 million for a total of about $45 million total so far spent on this project. Madam Chair, I'll leave it at that for now unless anybody has any questions.
I'll start with one. What is the and then Senator Yeager, what is the remaining amount of state funds that are needed?
Madam Chair, I don't have that broken out as far as the proportion of the remaining state versus federal, but we'll get that to you.
We can tell. My understanding was that it was nine million. Does that sound right?
No.
Madam Chair, Kim Rice. The estimated cost is around $523 for construction of the roadway. At 10%, which is about what our federal aid funding comes in, it'd be another $52 million for that.
Senator Egan, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What happens dollar-wise if there is a substantial delay in the completion of the EIS?
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Egan, that is still being sorted out right now. We are having communications with Federal Highways on the current status, working out scenarios both with them, what our options are, and as the administration is able to review this and put some sort of prioritization and give their vision for these large projects, some of that will start to flesh out. As of right now, we don't know the answer. Worst case scenario, if Federal Highways were to come back and charge us everything, there's $26 million of federal funds that have been expended so far. So that would be the worst case, is having to pay back all that. But up to this point, we don't know.
Yeah, follow-up, Madam Chair. So, Commissioner, what happens? Would we have to return that money to the feds?
Go ahead.
Okay. So there's been a lot of debate about this. So I just went to the source. It's 23 CFR 630 is the federal regulation. And it basically says that if you've got completed your environmental document and you've opened your right-of-way, you have 20 years. If you have, if you're still working or you're in just in preliminary engineering, it's 10 years. The end of the regulation says, the state may request a time extension beyond the 20-year limit with no repayment of federal funds, and the Federal Highway may approve this request if it is considered reasonable. So that's why we're working very closely with them, and we have to work through the scenarios. I can give you two examples. The Coastal Trail in Anchorage, we worked through an EIS. We got to the end of the process. That project was either supported by the state at one time or supported by the municipality at one time. It was never supported by both at the same time. So at the end of that, we came to a decision that we weren't going to build a project, and that's how it was written up, and we paid back nothing. The opposite is true of the Highway to Highway project that was just around a few years ago in Anchorage. We got to a point where the administration, and it was a controversial project, and they said, we don't want to go any further. We have the funding. We paid back directly the $10 million. However, the federal funding that was spent that's given back is put on another project. So the state doesn't really lose the federal funding, but we have to put back in general fund anything. So in a sense, you're expanding your program a little bit. That's the two scenarios that I know of that I've actually seen happen.
Thank you. Representative Klayman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Senator Egan's questions, the answers to Senator Egan's questions answered my questions. Thank you.
Senator Egan.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I just want to follow up, Commissioner Deputy. Senator Stedman brought it up about what happened to Gravina Island bridge funding. Went elsewhere. Away from coastal Alaska. What happens with all the money that has been appropriated so far in state dollars? Another $35,000 or $35 million last year. What happens to that, and what are the chances? I guess I don't trust folks of that money going elsewhere.
You want to take that one with the state?
So, when we develop our STIP or our program, and you're talking about the appropriated money, but I'm going to talk about the STIP okay. first, if that's all right. When
can
we develop,
address both.
Yes. Okay. When we develop our program, there's many flavors and colors of money, and I have to admit, lack of knowledge. If there's any, earmarked funding specifically for Juneau Access. I don't know if there is or not. But there's many colors and flavors of money. When we build our STIP program, we actually have things that, such as what we call AC, which is Advanced Construct. We build into the program some illustrative stuff so that we advertise and let people know in the plan there's projects out there that we're working on that we need to bring forward. Projects take anywhere from 5 years to 10 years to develop. Our STIP is only for 3 years. We have to have some flexibility to move projects around as they blow up, so to speak. And so some of those that we're going to be AC'd will now move into the program as regular construction, and we'll move the others as we develop the next plan out and see where they fall in. So we've got an amendment out right now to move the funding that was in the STIP today that will move it out into future years. And then when the new STIP comes out, it will show up depending on how everything settles out. So that's the future and what happens with funding. We usually carry about 30% over, and that's a national average of projects, just because things happen to projects and they have to be shuffled when you're talking about a program. As far as the appropriations on this one, as far as I know, there's still money dedicated or agreed to go to Ketchikan that's going to go on other projects in the Ketchikan area. I know less about Southeast than I do other parts of the state. But I would imagine some of that funding could potentially be reappropriated, to be perfectly honest. That's not totally within our control. But
okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Does the administration agree that the Juneau Access Road would save, we just heard about the ferries and the challenges and the subsidies. Does the administration agree that once the project were completed that it would actually save the ferry system and this type of approach, like I mentioned earlier, that's been done in other parts of the world is something that Alaska should move forward and do?
Madam Chair, the department, of course, is in a bit of a rocky spot, and we're transitioning. I can tell you what's happened in the recent history. What you spoke to about Norway, Canada, so the Southeast plan exists. It's been in process, it's in draft, and it does identify corridors. We don't just decide we're going to do a project out of nowhere. The federal program requires planning documents that have big picture vision, so to speak, and then from there projects come out of that plan. One of the projects that's in that plan is Juneau Access. Another project is Warm Springs Bay, Sitka to Warm Springs. Some of them, people will look at the long range plan and go, you're talking pipe dream here. There'll never be enough money, you know, that sort of thing. Other things upset people. They don't want to see a change in how we do business. I'm not advocating either way, but what I can tell you that those things are how where these projects come from. So there's a draft plan that was had a lot of public hearings last year. It was very controversial. It's still in draft. Policy direction, funding changes, things like that, and the plans end up changing. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I can say there is a plan out there.
Representative Millett.
Thank you, Chairman. So budget amendments are due to the legislature on February 18th. When is the decision going to be made, no go or go, on this project and the other project that you're going to talk to us about today on Kibata? Are you going to have a drop-dead date where we're going to know whether it's going to be included in the budget, or are we going to get some type of notification prior to that?
Through the chair. Yes, we're still having those conversations with the governor's office and working through some of these scenarios and assessments during review process. So I would say hopefully in the near future, but don't have a good stake to put in the ground for you on those.
Follow-up, Jim? So near future, February 18th, should we have expected around there?
Through the chair, I would hope so.
Thank you.
Any other questions on that? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just want the department to know and that I'm a road guy. I still support the road. So, thank you.
Thank you. I have a question out of curiosity. And are you aware that after the prior commissioner issued the memo, was there a sit-down meeting and discussion and conversation about it and with the governor? And
Madam Chair, I am not aware of those kind of discussions. The administrative order did request reply and kind of assessment of each of these projects, and the prior commissioner did provide that to the governor's office. And the last I've heard on that matter.
Okay, thank you. And since you're in the hot seat, and we've got all these projects here, could as far as the six there, what do you consider the most shovel ready of the six?
That's a good question.
Madam Chair, we've only been involved in the two recently, so I don't think we couldn't comment on that very
okay,
well.
Then I'll narrow it down to the ones that are directly that are part of DOTs in your purview.
They're both pretty far along in development. Juno Access, had there not been the court case, it would have gone to construction. Now there's things that are going to have to change as a result of the document. That's not to say that another court case couldn't occur. So, again, that's another reason we carry fund, you know, more than other projects in our program. So Juno Access was fairly far along in design, and they had opened right-of-way at one time, but they had closed it. In the case of Kinnick Arm, they've purchased 86% of the right-of-way. So it's kind of a toss-up. On the other hand, last year, their whole funding structure got changed.
Other questions? Okay, with that, as the clock continues to tick, we will move to the Susitna-Watonna Dam project. And I believe we have Sarah Fisher-Gold there. So if you will come up, and we'll just move right in without taking at ease. If you introduce yourself, Sarah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Sarah Fisher-Gold. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. I did have a PowerPoint presentation, but I think we'll just move right to our memo that we had provided to the Admin Order 271. I will say that the PowerPoint that's been provided to the committee is really an update. It's an abridged version of a one-hour update that we provided to our Board of Directors in December to provide information with respect to our where we're at in the process with our FERC licensing process for the project. So it's a pretty thorough update. Again, this is a bit more of an abridged version, and I'd be more than happy to meet with any legislator who wants some additional information with respect to the project. The authorized funds so far with respect to this project is $192 million. We have spent $158 million of the funds, And as outlined in the administrative order, we have approximately $20 million that have been encumbered. If the project were to be shelved at this point, we have some additional work that we think needs to be done to be able to appropriately shut down this project to make sure that the information, the data that has been collected and the work that's been done to date is useful for a future time and a potential development. So if the project were to be shut down, we would have approximately $6.6 million of available funds from existing appropriations. With respect, just real quickly on the project, some of the licensing milestones that we've had this year is that we had our initial study report that was filed with FERC. This is a very extensive report. We've had several stakeholder meetings with respect to this. We have actually completed, of our 58 studies, we've completed the data collection of of 13 of those studies. We have made a very thorough report that's statutorily required that was made available to the legislature on January 20th. Each of you should have received an email with a link to that report. And essentially, it does provide the full annual update of where we're at with the project. So with that, Madam Chair, instead of going through the PowerPoint, I'm more than happy to answer any questions with respect to where we're at with the project. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Sarah, I'm halfway through the report. So, question, how much more money would be required to get a FERC license?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we anticipate that would be $102 million to get to the license. And I should say, too, if there are any technical questions with respect to where we're at with the project, Wayne Dyack, our project manager, is online from Anchorage.
And excuse me, one quick follow-up, ma'am. And timeline, $102 million to get to license, and the timeline?
With respect to the timeline, if $102 million were appropriated this year, I think I'll ask Wayne to answer. I mean, in that scenario, Wayne, can you tell us when we'd be able to file a license, assuming that we would stay on an integrated licensing process? Wayne, are you online?
Yes. For the record, my name is Wayne Dyack with the Alaska Energy Authority. You know, through the chair, the timeline with the $102 million would be that we would be filing our license application in early 2017 with an expected issuance from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission around the end of 2018. So to be ready to start construction in 2019.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Representative Clayman.
Thank you. Through the chair, after the $102 million to get the permit, what's the current estimated cost, total estimated cost of construction after the license is in place?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, the current estimated cost of the project, we do have the engineering feasibility report that will be published later this month. The estimated cost of the project, I believe, is, and this is in the PowerPoint presentation that you have, with the base estimate is $5.655 billion.
$5.6 billion.
And through the chair, one thing I did want to mention with respect to that is that we also in this presentation have some information on, you know, we've had three tracks on development of this project. We've had the environmental work, which significant or most of the money has gone towards supporting that and collecting the data and the information needed for to comply with our study plan determination from FERC. The estimate for the cost and what we've done in the financing portion of this would be looking at the various ways that the project could be financed. There's never ever been an assumption that that the state would appropriate the $5 billion to build the project. It would be a financing. It would be a financing process. It would not. It would be through power sales agreements and through probably a combination of loans and bonds.
Okay. Thank you. Is there another question on this one, Senator Michiki?
Well, I just have one in general. I just personally think, I mean, you think about how the best organizations are run, and they periodically in some cases annually, pause to prioritize projects. I think it's a healthy exercise. I mean, through the years, some of these projects may drop off. In some cases, we may add new ones. And I've been a little bit frustrated on the lack of infrastructure investment related to access, commerce, you know, and energy. But I think it's healthy. There's a new administration, and to give them fair credit, it's a good kind of cutoff point to reprioritize and evaluate which way we're going. So I don't think anyone's saying these projects go away forever. I think it's a healthy pause, and I'm going to support it somewhat vocally. And I have various ranges of support for these six projects. Some I'm very supportive of. Some I'm less supportive of, to put it that way, but I think it's okay. I think it's a healthy process.
Thank you for that input, Senator. And I will say, even I don't know if this represents what you have back at home in your districts, but I hear quite the range on these various mm-hmm. projects as well. So mm-hmm. I think it is indeed a good exercise. I have one question. Maybe you might have been jotting down a note when you said it. So if you already said it, I apologize for asking again. But if we were to shelve this and bring it back online when things improved, what would be the additional cost the state would incur ramping it back up again, that the best guess you could give? That we wouldn't have to, a cost we wouldn't otherwise have if we kept going.
Madam Chair, I think that's something that we've internally been struggling with on, you know, what that would be or what the shelf life would be for this project. As the committee is aware, you know, this project was shelved in the 80s after the state had spent $140 million. And although the information to show, trends and consistency was with respect to the data, and that 80s data was very valuable, we essentially did have to get a complete new study plan determination, and an approval from FERC to move forward on the 58 studies. So at this point, I don't know if we have much of an estimate on what that would be and how long we could have a pause and what that cost would be. I think there's too many factors. I think it's very safe to say that it would be the $102 million plus an extra number that I'm not exactly sure what that would be. And I don't know, Wayne, if you have an educated guess with respect to that, sorry to put you on the spot on that one.
Thank you, sir. Through the chair, I don't really have an educated guess. I think you hit it correctly, sir. It depends on how long the pop. The data would have some, shelf life, 3-4 years maybe. After that, I think there would be a cry to update some of the information. So the answer and cost would depend upon how much the pause. Is it 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, or 5 years, or beyond that? If it's probably beyond 5 years, I'm sure we would be, starting this process over again. Somewhere between 0 and 5 years, there would be a cost. But I think we'd have to kind of look at that, and that is something that we could probably get, work through with Sarah and get some scenarios to you.
Okay, thank you. That would be good. That's information we can get out to everyone. If there's not any more questions on this one, we'll move on. We still have two that we're going to quickly go through. So thank you very much, Sarah. And we'll now look at the Kodiak Launch Complex, and I believe Craig Campbell, are you online? And you can take it away and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, yes. Craig Campbell, President and CEO of Alaska Aerospace Corporation. I'm online in Anchorage.
If you want to give us a quick overview, and you heard some, were you on earlier, so you heard the kind of questions that we are wanting to know the answers to?
Yes, Madam Chair, I've been listening the last couple hours, and I will give you a very short overview. In 2012, the legislature approved $25 million in capital funds to be used by Alaska Aerospace for the development of medium lift out at the Kodiak Launch Complex. And that project was gated, the $25 million was gated into three phases. The first phase was $3 million for design, engineering, infrastructure, prep, and environmental work, which we could do right away. The next phase was $10 million, which we could not spend until we had a signed contract. And the third phase was for $12 million, and that could only be spent once we had the additional funding necessary to build a full medium lift complex out there, which was estimated at that time to be about $125 million. So So we were going to need to raise $100 million against the $25 million of the state to be able to provide medium lift. The two primary companies that were interested were Orbital Sciences and Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin was the one that expressed the direct interest in going to Kodiak. Orbital had work they were still doing at Wallops and could not meet a time schedule we had provided. So the legislation actually was directed for an Athena 3 rocket by Lockheed Martin to be built at Kodiak, the launch structure for medium lift at Kodiak, and that's what the legislation passed. Over the last 2 years, Lockheed has been unable to build a business case for the Athena 3, which is a large rocket, but they were able to build a business case for an Athena 2S, which is a smaller rocket but has potential, lift potential to do medium lift. Along with that, we know SpaceX, another company that provides launch services, was moving to Brownsville, Texas to establish a facility there for launch of rockets, and so this summer, we decided to do a request for proposals to the world, to the industry, to say, is anybody out there still interested in medium lift in Alaska? We received four proposals. We shortlisted down to two for interviews, and we selected on December 12th, we selected Lockheed Martin and the Athena 2S to go ahead and proceed with the medium lift opportunities at Kodiak. The uniqueness of this was that for us to convert the existing launch facility at Kodiak to medium lift would only require about a $3 to $4 million investment, not the $125 million that would have been required for the Athena 3. We have not issued a contract. About that time, the governor issued AO 271 and asked us to stop put a hold on that project, and we complied. We advised Lockheed that we will not be proceeding until we have approval from the governor to go ahead and proceed with medium lift. So we at this time have made it known to the governor that $22 million of the $25 million appropriation is available to the state, and we would like to have about the remaining $2.3 million of the $3 million of phase one to complete medium lift for Lockheed Martin's Athena 2S at Kodiak. We have spent about $700,000 so far on design and other work to prepare ourselves for it. We've done no construction towards medium lift. The only outstanding project right now is the environmental assessment. It's virtually done. We're in the last phase. It's an FAA environmental assessment. It probably will be completed within the next 60 days. So at this time, we're on hold and already have identified that $22 million that was part of that $25 million appropriation is available for reappropriation or back to the state.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? I thought you might have one. Representative Stutz.
Do you have a, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious if you have any potential launches lined up in the near future, provided that this is rebuilt.
Through the Chair, Representative Stutz, we are in the process of rebuilding Launch Pad 1. That was not impacted by the AO 271. That is being built with insurance money, not designated appropriated money from the legislature. So that project is ongoing, and we should have that completed by October of this year for our customer that had the last launch that's planning another launch in 2016.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, oh, yes, we do. Go ahead.
I have one more. I'm sorry. And you're rebuilding, and are you rebuilding just for small rocket launch, or will, when you rebuild, will you have the capability of both small and medium rocket launches?
Through the chair, we will only be rebuilding to small lift. We are rebuilding the damaged facilities under the insurance program that we're doing right now. If we are authorized to move forward with medium lift, that additional $3 to $4 million utilizing the $2.3 million left from the appropriation, that would be an additional project added to the current project to provide the medium capability. The reconstruction right now with insurance will not provide medium lift capability at Kodiak.
Can I have a follow-up, please? So I'm not sure that I understood you. What would be the additional costs to allow medium lifts in the rebuilding process?
No, I understand, it is complicated. I apologize, Representative Stutz. The Athena 2S, which is a medium lift rocket, is the size that fits into our current facility for small lift. It's not a tall rocket, so it fits into the current facility. However, it's a lot heavier, so it requires a new stool, It has different umbilical connections, so we have to relocate where the wires and the attachments to the rocket would go. And we'd have to have different paneling for the levels of work when they're working on the rocket in that site. That's what the about $3 to $4 million cost is. So it would be a retrofit inside the existing facility for medium lift.
Thank you.
And I have one question. As far as we heard about the mishap, I believe it was this summer. Are those repairs completed, and did insurance cover those costs?
Madam Chair, the repairs are not done. We are in the process of a demolition contract right now. We're removing all the damaged pieces and parts, and the insurance adjuster engineers are down there to assess the work that's going to be required for rebuild. It's estimated it's going to be about $29 million. It's going to be paid for out of our insurance. We've been paying into the insurance fund since we've been in existence. And so that reconstruction will probably start in about another 6 weeks to be completed by October.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir, for being online. We're going to move to the Knick Arm Crossing. And I believe we're bringing back up Acting Commissioner and Kim Rice, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Several things that Knick Arm have already been discussed, but we'll continue on those.
Can you put your name on the record again?
I will. And for the record, I'm John Binder, Acting Commissioner for Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. For the Knick Arm Crossing, the proposed action for that project is to improve surface transportation between the municipality of Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna Valley by constructing a bridge across the Knick Inlet. There are several pieces currently in place. I'll just go down kind of in no particular order. There is a letter of authorization required from the National Marine Fisheries Service for the beluga whales that will be interrupted there during the construction due to the Marine Mammals Protection Act. That letter has been requested. Anticipated time for that is approximately 11 to 13 months or so, so quite a while left on that. As was mentioned earlier, right-of-way acquisition, we're about 86% of the properties acquired for that. The remaining properties are primarily government to governments. That includes J-Bear, Municipality of Anchorage, Alaska Railroad, etc., that are still needed, but those have all been put on pause as a result of the AO-271. Another piece, a big piece, is the TIFIA loan requirement, which is one-third, kind of the third pillar there of the overall funding structure for that project. It includes a couple different pieces. One needs a letter of interest. That's a whole stage, a letter of interest stage, in which eligibility is determined, as well as credit worthiness of the state and the entities involved. The other piece is the application stage, where the loan strives to be conditionally approved. And federal budget authority is obligated at that time. The total process for that is anticipated to take a good 12 to 18 months and probably a little bit longer. Some other pieces that are a part of that are the toll piece being figured out, and that's one of the procurement items that still remains, which has been put on hold. So those are kind of the updates of the pieces that are in place. And internal stuff for with contractors that have already been obligated is going, but otherwise pretty much a pause on those. The remaining items that had not been gone into contract yet is contractor procurement. There we do. It's going to be a design-build project, so need RFO and RFP on that for the contractor to determine who that's going to be and what the design will be. That'll be about an 18-month process. An owner's representative procurement, be a contractor to assist in developing all the contractual documents required and then to oversee the administration and the execution of the construction contract. The tolling contractor procurement needs to be done as well, and that contractor will both design the tolling system and then be responsible for running it and maintaining it after construction as well. And the final piece is to find a contractor procurement there for performing the annual audit that's required by the legislative, by the statute that was passed last year. Some funding pieces, again, has been mentioned. The rough estimate right now is about a $1 billion project. So far, there's been about $73 million worth of federal funding that has been expended. State funds have been about $6 million. Excuse me. And then some other GF items as well for about $5.5 million. So total monies expended so far is about $84.8 million. Madam Chair, that concludes what we have today, barring any questions.
Senators, do you have a question? We're getting down to just a few people at the table. I have a question. What are, if we delay regarding the TIFIA, I've heard, you know, there's open opportunities, open windows with that. What kind of costs, additional costs, might we expect if we push back I guess it's an application for the TIFIA, or?
I guess the big piece is not so much cost because the TIFIA application is delayed, but that a delay in that potentially impacts other pieces, whether it's the whale permits, the EIS pieces, anything beyond a 2 to 3 year or so delay. Now some of those things start expiring and having to be redone.
And I guess that's my question then. Those things that would need to be redone, have you looked at what that would, what kind of cost that would be to the state to redo those things if we delay?
Madam Chair, no, we have not. Very similar to the Susitna project as well. There, again, it kind of depends on how long we'll determine how much of that needs to be redone. So based on the scenarios and that we're working out with the administration.
So, Madam Chair, Kim Rice, Deputy Commissioner. FHWA kind of has a rule of thumb of 3 years, and then they'll want a document refresh. That's kind of what they look at. That doesn't mean you have to redo everything, but you have to figure out if there's any laws that have changed, any impacts have changed. You know, Beluga could become, you know, just like during this process, during this project, that became listed. It didn't exist before as a listing. So things can change that will affect our permits, and it's true, our permits expire. So we can't really predict, but if nothing changes in terms of footprint and impacts and laws don't change, then we just say it all looks good. So it's just a review.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Rice, how long would the traffic count study be relevant as it pertains to the TIFIA loan process?
Good question.
That is, we'll probably have to get back to you on that. I can say that, you know, a traffic study is a model, and you have different inputs depending on what planning and sort of things happen. So again, it's just a model depending. Revenues, development can change based on what's occurring today and, you know, in the markets. So,
I heard you mention that 86% of the right-of-way has been purchased, and all the private property is my understanding. So what's left is, as you said, government to government. So I just want to make that clear on the record. And then also, when we look at the growth, probably one of the number one things I hear about in my office has to do with people trying to move about. It's just growing so much in my area and a lot of concern. And I was a commuter as well for 6 years. And I believe in 25 years, the estimate is that that traffic on the Glen Highway would double if nothing else were done. So my question, and I know you're it's still considered transition time. We'll let you use that excuse for maybe a week, and then after that, no more. Do you have the sense that the administration in general supports the project? It's more a funding issue at this point as a solution to the growth in that area and to open up areas. And Anchorage is kind of surrounded by mountains and water. And I understand they need a certain number. In fact, why they're coming out our way is because there's the space there in the Anchorage area is limited. So,
Madam Chair, yes, good question. I guess I'd go back to Senator Machicki's comments earlier there of the health of this type of a process every now and then for these major projects. Haven't been able to sort out yet as we're having the review process. The level of support or not from the governor's administration there, but I know they're stepping back and reviewing everything, making sure priorities are correctly aligned, especially considering the state's fiscal climate here as we move forward. So I would expect more of that to be revealed here in the future.
So if the price of oil per barrel were $130, I'm just wondering if he would support it. That's my question, and you don't feel like you can actually say that at this point?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on that? We have one more really, really quick, and I believe we have Miles Baker for from AGDC and Frank Richards also online. And so, gentlemen, if you're there, if you introduce yourself, you kind of hear the format. If you could give us a quick synopsis and where we stand with the ASAP line.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It's, for the record, it's Frank Richards, Vice President of Engineering and Program Management for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And I'm accompanied here by Miles Baker, our Vice President of External Affairs and Government Relations. So I believe Ginger has a slide pack that we developed for this to give you a quick overview on the status of the project, where we are, how much we've spent, and then the spend rate that we are, have talked about in response to the AO-271. Do you have access to that slide pack, Madam Chairman?
Yes, we've got it up now, so go ahead.
Okay, slide number two. Briefly, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation was charged by the legislature under Alaska Statute 3125 in House Bill 4 in developing the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project to really to provide for energy relief for Alaskans. And so with the passage of HB 4, we were granted $355 million to advance the ASAP project through an open season and ultimately to a project sanction decision. We've been working over the last 3 years to be able to accomplish that, and we've just now completed our Class 3 estimate and project execution plan, which would have been the precursors to going into a regulatory filing with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and an open season. However, in response to the legislative passage and ultimate signing of Senate Bill 138, with the involvement of the state in the Alaska LNG project, then that really changed the policy in regards to the ASAP schedule, because it meant that we would need to align our projects to be able to co-align with the decision point within Alaska LNG on whether or not to proceed into FEED. So with the passage of 138, we did initiate an extensive review of all the work activities that we would be going forward, and essentially realigned our schedule to that 1Q, or first quarter of 2016, Alaska LNG FEED decision. So the effects of that are that we have essentially delayed some of our commercial activities, which is the recourse filing and the open season, and then we've looked forward for our work programs to scale those to maintain the viability and readiness of the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, but also to perform work that would be of value and benefit to not only the ASAP project, but also to the AKLNG project, because right now, we have approximately 98% of our center line is a common center line alignment between the two projects. So that means that all of the work that we are currently doing and have done has value to both projects. So to that extent, we had been working on revising our 2015-2016 spend plan, which we provided in response to the administrative order to OMB on January 5th, and then ultimately presented that to our board of directors on January 8th. And then moving to slide number three, Madam Chairman, this spend curve identifies the original spend plan that we had as an outcome of House Bill 4 to get to project sanction, which would have had us spending approximately $150 million over the next 15 to 16 months to advance the ASAP project. But as I just described, we look to reduce and delay our schedule, so we came up with what we now defining as our new 15-16 work plan and reduced approximately $90 million of expenditures, or approximately a 60% reduction in anticipated costs. Next slide, please, Madam Chairman. So the outcome of that will be that we'll be delaying or deferring some of our activities. As I've said, the commercial activities, but also some of our design efforts that we would normally have proceeded with after an open season, which would have been essentially redesigning portions of the project to meet the shipper commitments, because it's really going to depend on what the shippers want the project to do, and B, that we would then make modifications to meet their expectations, which would potentially mean redesigning our gas conditioning facility to accommodate the new Point Thompson gas that will be available with the ExxonMobil developments. And then looking at potentially intermediate compressor stations, and then procurement of the long lead time items like equipment and pipe,
and specifically the major modules that would be needed for a gas conditioning facility. And then lastly, we would have started our construction execution contracting in advance of a major execution. So to date, we have spent approximately $176 million to develop the work that we have proceeded with on ASAP, following the intents of the Alaska legislature under HB 4. Moving on to slide number 5, this is a reflection of the revised schedule that, as an outcome of 138 and realignment of the two projects, we now see that we're looking to that one quarter of 2016 for a decision to advance either with an AKLNG project as the project of choice for Alaska, or if that does not proceed, then to continue on with ASAP and do the recourse tariff filing, the open season, and then ultimately the project sanction and execution with first gas now showing in 2024. That's all in line with what we felt was the legislative intent, which was to have a backup project for the Alaska LNG project, and that was going to be ASAP. So I would also recognize that the funding that has been provided to the ASAP for this work has all been general funds that have been placed into the in-state natural gas pipeline fund created specifically for use and advancement of this project. There are no federal funds that are being used on this project.
Senator Michiki.
So, Madam Chairman, that's a very quick overview of our status and update on the ASAP project.
Good job, Frank. Appreciate it. Senator Michiki has a question for you.
Yeah, I just for the record, wanted to direct people to the online resources from Senate Resources on the 21st of January. Mr. Richards and the AGDC team gave a great presentation of ASAP overview, and it's very thorough if folks have other questions.
Okay. And I just have one kind of general question that, unless Senator Michiki has something else. I know that much of the work that you've done ties in and is helpful and usable as far as the Alaska LNG project. Looking ahead, if the project were not halted, how much more could there still be overlap as far as what you would spend that would still go into the other project? Because at some point, dollars you would be spending wouldn't be applicable to the other project, but is there still some that would go toward the other project as well?
Madam Chairman, again, Frank Richards, the spend curve that we show on, I believe it was slide number 3, that $60 million, our efforts were to continue work efforts that would have the transferability and durability to benefit a pipeline project in Alaska. So, for instance, we are now out in the field doing winter field work that will have benefit to both AKLNG and ASAP. We'll continue on with some of our environmental and regulatory work that will have benefit to both AKLNG and to ASAP. Our whole goal was to, again, align ourselves with a spend plan that would have that major transferability. Again, ASAP has completed what is known as front-end engineering and design for the ASAP project, and we are essentially several years ahead of and advanced in our work as opposed to the Alaska LNG project, which is now in the pre-FEED or pre-front-end engineering and design efforts. So we have a lot of very detailed engineering, environmental work, regulatory work that is of benefit to that project.
Okay, appreciate that. And if I were more familiar with it, I wouldn't be asking this question. But of the $60 million, do you already have some of that, or is that $60 million would be money that you would still need to be appropriated?
Madam Chairman, the legislature funded us with a full $355 million in 2013, and so what's represented here is money that is in the in-state natural gas pipeline fund available for the project. Okay. So no new general funds are being asked for.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. I do recall that at the beginning now. Anything else?
know when you're ready to close.
Yeah, we are ready to close, and appreciate everyone's patience and those that stuck with it. You all get 5 gold stars. I'll just to get on the record here, we will be meeting next Tuesday. The House Transportation will be down in the room in room 17, and Tuesday we'll do an overview of the highways and public facilities, and Thursday we'll do a department-wide overview, and then with a little focus on aviation. And also Nancy Hemingway, or I just want to, you weren't mentioned at the beginning, so I just want to mention and thank you as the record staff, and be working with our committee this session. So we appreciate that. And then also Graham Judson with Representative Foster's office, and Ginger Blaisdell with my office will be working with us. And I'm going to turn things over to Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The gavel, too.
Oh, okay. Well, Senate Transportation will be meeting Tuesdays and Thursdays at 1 in the Butrovich Room. We're taking, we won't be scheduling meetings for next week. We'll be kicking off the following week. And my staff is Lynn Smith behind me, my trusty, incredible staff. And other than that, this meeting is adjourned at 3:27, Madam Chair.